Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
If you're a kid right now, life is nothing like it used to be.
Well, I'm not gonna lie, it's been pretty difficult.
It's been weird.
Weird doesn't even begin to describe it. If you graduated, you had no crowd to cheer you on.
We walked across the stage in an empty theater with the dean giving us our diplomas.
You miss your friends.
I just want to be with them.
You even miss going to school.
You get to like do activities and all this fun stuff.
A lot.
Yes, makes me very emotional inside.
And your mom is on you all the time.
Put on your mask, always wear your gloves.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is Class of COVID-19, a special production from The Pulse. What's it like to grow up in the shadow of a pandemic? When the world around you shuts down, when everything you enjoy doing is not allowed, closed, canceled. We'll look at the impact of the pandemic on kids' health, well-being, and development. First, open up or not? That's the question schools are dealing with right now, and families are freaking out about. In-person instruction has lots of parents worried about the risk of infection. Online instruction means massive headaches in terms of childcare. The U.S. education system isn't really one system. It's more like a network of little kingdoms with their own leaders and customs and mascots. There are over 13,000 public school districts in this country and more than 33,000 private schools. And they're all trying to do the right thing for their students and employees. Avi Wolfman-Aaron takes us to three cities in the Philadelphia area and tells us how school leaders there are trying to tackle this enormous challenge.
The school hallway looks like it's been frozen in time.
So welcome to a school building with no children.
I'm at Camden Prep, a charter school in New Jersey. And administrator Natalie Cooper is pointing to walls lined with A-plus quizzes and papers.
Through the hallways, you can see the kids and the work back from March. We literally have not been back in the school building.
In mid-March, American education came to a dramatic, screeching halt. Schools across the country shifted as fast as they could to online learning. It was one of the hardest things many educators have ever done in their careers. Until now.
I'd say the biggest hurdle to overcome has been the uncertainty, sort of back and forth about we're coming back, we're not coming back, we're coming back, we're not coming back.
We're coming back, we're not coming back. That decision hangs over every school leader in America, from those that run 100,000 student school districts to those that run small private schools. Catherine Savage is one of the latter.
Yes, we rent space here in the church, so actually, why don't we walk into the sanctuary? It's the
Catherine is in charge of a small private school in the heart of Philadelphia. The sanctuary usually serves as a gathering space for morning meetings, celebrations, concerts.
And this has been the place for many happy school-wide student assemblies, which, unfortunately, we will not be able to have this year.
Catherine says online or distance learning in the spring had been tough for just about all of her roughly 100 students.
What we notice is after about a month of distance learning, only the really strong survive. And even those strong are really miserable.
She says kids, teachers, and parents all wanted to return to in-classroom instruction. But every time she started to think about how they would make it happen, she got hung up on all the things they wouldn't be able to do.
For me, especially as, you know, the leader of the school, you have a vision for what you're trying to give to the students and what you want to do with the students. And so when that's interrupted, I met that interruption initially with just a lot of frustration.
It wasn't until late June that the frustration turned into resolve. Opening school was a puzzle, and she was gonna solve it.
And once I shifted my mentality, then the puzzle seemed less burdensome.
Catherine's school, Philadelphia Classical, will be open 5 days a week for all students. Kids will move through the school in small, isolated cohorts to cut down on the likelihood of widespread outbreaks. And every bit of space has been utilized to create more room. The sanctuary will now be a big classroom for the older kids. And there's an emphasis on ventilation. Open doors, open windows, spread out.
I'm going to send out an email to all our older students saying, bring a picnic blanket and put it on top of the lockers and be ready to take that under your arm during your lunch break and eat outside.
The fact that Catherine can make a casual suggestion like that in an email brings us to an important point. Philadelphia Classical School is small.
We do have that luxury that we have a smaller community and we have a lot of parent buy-in.
Across the river from Philadelphia at Camden Prep in New Jersey, Natalie Cooper has a slightly larger task. Camden Prep is part of Uncommon Schools, a charter school network that has two campuses in the city and about 800 students.
So we spent basically the past few weeks gearing up and getting ready for what this is all going to look like.
The plan right now is for students to come to school in shifts so that basically you have half the kids in school on a given day. The extra space allows for more distancing.
Come on down, I'll show you what a 15-kid classroom will look like.
In this model kindergarten classroom, all the desks face forward and are spread out to reduce the possibility of kids breathing on each other. A liquid disinfectant coats the floor.
So they did this room this morning, cleaned it as if it were, you know, as if kids would be coming in a few hours.
There are so many things to consider in a return to school plan. Take something as simple as dismissal. Instead of doing it all in 15 minutes, like in normal times, Uncommon Schools will dismiss kids in shifts over the course of an hour to help spread people out.
It's going to take much longer.
And that's one part of one plan. Natalie's team actually has three plans. One for all virtual, one for all in person, and one for the in-between that they're doing right now. The goal is to be able to switch among these modes seamlessly.
So that's what I think our new mentality is about all this. It's about being nimble. It's about being adaptable.
School leaders are trying to solve a problem that keeps changing. In normal times, it takes years for scientific thought to migrate into real-life practice. Now we're asking educators to make real-time sense of a disease that scientists are themselves just learning about. That means long Zoom meetings and endless email chains.
It probably starts about 6 in the morning and stops at 12 each night, midnight. We're asking each other questions. We're reading. We found something. We share it.
Robin Ruiz runs Hope Community Charter School, also in Camden, New Jersey. She has a tight-knit team of 25 staffers, and that helps them stay flexible. But the hamster wheel of new information can be tiring.
You create your plan. The temperature guidelines change. So you change the temperature guidelines. The mask guidelines change. So you're always changing something.
Robin says she takes most of her cues from government health authorities, local and national. But there can be contradictions in the guidance, says Annette Anderson, a professor at Johns Hopkins University who's been tracking school reopening plans around the country. She gives the example of plexiglass dividers. Many schools, like Robin's, are considering using them to form little cocoons around students' desks.
Then it's, if you do purchase them, how wide should they be? Should they be a quarter of an inch thick? Should it be half an inch? And the guidance is all over the place.
With all of these moving parts, Annette says many large school districts are opting to start the year online. Remember Catherine Savage at that small private school sending an email about outdoor lunch? Annette plays out a similar scenario, but in a large school district with lots of kids and buildings and staff and work rules.
You know, for example, when you talk about having kids eat their lunch in the classroom, well, that sounds like a great idea to parents. But then you have to figure out who would supervise those kids. And then you've got to figure out how will you get the lunches to the classrooms. And so once you get to the third layer of some of these conversations, it kind of falls apart a little bit.
Christopher Dormer runs the public school system in Norristown, a small city just northwest of Philadelphia. His district has almost 8,000 students.
Back in March and April, we thought the hardest thing we were going to have to do was close schools. I can tell you now, in going through this reopening process, closing schools looks like a walk in the park to all the challenges we're facing.
At one point, he and his team were looking at 16 different sets of guidance from different government entities and health organizations. Christopher usually gets about 6 hours of sleep a night. Not this summer.
There was a good couple week period where if I was getting three, I was lucky. You know, I mean, literally up till, you know, 2:33 in the morning, you know, just agonizing over decisions.
At the end of July, he called it. For the first semester, his district would be 100% virtual. When he looked at all the evidence, he felt it was just too messy and contradictory to trust.
You know, I'm not willing to risk anyone's life on the what ifs.
Christopher felt like a district his size had the muscle to really make online learning work if everyone was rowing in the same direction. But the idea of going back and forth between in-person and online made him uneasy.
Mentally and physically being able to flip that switch is not a seamless process.
School leaders are used to making tough calls.
You wear two skins, Kevlar and Teflon. You got to be bulletproof when people come at you, and you got to let things, you know, so much is thrown at you, you got to let it slide.
But this felt different. The logistics were dizzying. The science kept changing. And there was always that thought looming over everything. What if someone gets really sick or dies?
It's not something I can think about right now. I can't get down that road.
That's Robin Ruiz again from Camden, New Jersey. She's trying to suppress those worst case thoughts and focus on all the little details that will make her school as safe as possible this fall.
As stressful as it is, there's a level of commitment in this building that I can't describe. Teachers go above and beyond. Staff members go above and beyond. And it humbles me to see a group of people work so hard.
It's been a summer of choked back tears and lost sleep. Now, America's schools are opening again in all their various forms. There is science behind the decisions, but humans who've had to make them. For The Pulse, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
This is Class of COVID-19, a special production from The Pulse about the impact of the pandemic on kids' lives.
Hi, my name is Rhea Muhammad. I'm 15 years old.
The school Rhea attends will be going all virtual until at least November.
I'm actually like really bummed out. I was really hoping to, you know, go back to school and see my friends and interact with my teachers once again and just really feel that fresh new start of a new year. I tend to learn better when I'm face to face with the teacher. I can interact with them and I have a bond with them, rather than being online and I don't have the opportunity to ask questions because I'm feeling shy and stuff like that.
Rhea says it's also hard to stay motivated and to get assignments done on time in an online setting. This situation is uncharted territory for educators.
We really didn't have a good model for understanding what this could mean for learning loss, for academics, for kids' social-emotional needs.
That's Megan Kufeld. She's a senior research scientist at NWEA in Portland, Oregon. It's an organization that partners with school districts to evaluate student learning.
We have reason to believe it probably wasn't as effective as being in person in school during the spring, but there's also just a huge variation across the country in terms of what's happened, with some students, you know, receiving very little interaction with their teachers, whereas other students were receiving multiple hours a day of kind of synchronous instruction and interaction with their classmates and teachers. So there's quite a lot of variability, and that likely will result in variability in learning outcomes as well.
What do you think are the biggest factors that really contribute to learning loss or to kids not making gains? Is it the frequency of instruction that's really important? Is it the routine? Is it the constant repetition of things? Like, what are some of the big factors here?
One of the biggest factors is whether or not kids have a quiet place at home to learn, whether they have a family member at home who can help, you know, particularly for younger children, who can help facilitate the online learning, because we know that young kids just don't do as well, one, sitting in place for long periods of time, but also have just challenges with technology that older kids may not have. And so for those kids who don't have internet access, who don't have a quiet place at home, who don't have a computer or device that they can use, those are the kids that are going to be kind of increasingly disengaged as this continues.
For kids who had some of the supports that you mentioned, for kids who had a quiet place, who had some support at home, are you worried long term about the impact of this, or do you have sort of a gut instinct that they will bounce back?
I think for the most part, they'll bounce back. It's hard to say how long this will all last. I think that's part of the real challenge. And, you know, if it was just the 3 months of school in the spring, I would say, you know, most kids will probably struggle a bit this year, but bounce back. But if it's just if we don't have a vaccine, if we don't reopen all fall, that's where I start to get worried that even kids who are well supported, the longer this goes, the tougher it's going to be to bounce back from.
I'm thinking most kids are used to devices being a place where they do more fun stuff, you know, watch a show, play a game, chat with their friends. And then now those same devices are being used as a place where you have to focus and you have to pay attention. And that's like a lot. That's asking a lot to make that switch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest things that has been really challenging for a lot of kids is, you know, we're asking kids to basically sit in front of a device or a computer for 3 hours, 6 hours a day and focus and pay attention. I mean, I struggle with that as an adult. Like, yeah. There's a lot of executive functioning skills and, you know, really important skills that have allowed me to kind of be able to do that, to throw a kid into that, you know, especially when the material may not be as engaging as a video game or a TV show. The engagement piece, I think, is one of the hardest things to measure, but also one of the most important things we'll need to be able to understand to know whether kids are actually learning or not, is just how they're actually engaging and how we can best develop practices for teachers and, you know, for the types of instructions that is provided to improve engagement when kids are not in the classroom. I think that's a big challenge.
Megan Kuhfeld is a senior research scientist at NWEA. That's an organization that partners with school districts to evaluate student learning. The abrupt and somewhat bumpy switch to online learning has probably affected kids' academic development, but it goes beyond that. What about all the stuff you learn in school that has nothing to do with textbooks and exams? Over the summer, we worked with a group of high school reporters. Jad Slayman teamed up with them and has this story.
School sucks. Ask any kid. But it turns out the only thing worse is not being able to go back. That and Zoom.
All you're doing is just staring at a screen all day and not doing anything else.
That's Nicholas Orlando Gonzalez. He's 10, lives in Philly. He's talking to one of the Pulse's student reporters, his cousin Caitlin Rodriguez.
Do you like online school? Do you feel like it's difficult or do you feel like it's
kind of difficult because at school, when you're actually at school, it's different because you get to, like, do activities with your friends and all this fun stuff, and it's just so difficult because you're just staring at a screen all day, and it's boring. It's like being tortured by the internet.
On the one hand, like lots of adults, he's scared of the virus.
It's the lungs that are affected that they can't breathe. And that's how their lives are ending, and I'm not trying to have that because I'm too young to die.
But he misses his friends, tells our student reporter about his best friend, Akeem, how they used to hang all the time, how they were fourth graders together, and now they're technically fifth graders, just not together.
Do any of those things, you know, make you sad that you can't see your teachers and friends?
Yes, it makes me very emotional and sad.
Well, how do you cope with being sad? What do you do to be less sad or be less mad that you can't go out anymore?
I kind of like rest it off, or I just cry until I feel like stop crying, until I feel like I need to stop crying.
Why do you cry?
Because it's just so hard that I don't get to see my friends no more. I just miss them all so much.
Remote learning for kids like Nicholas is all the boring parts of school without any of the fun little moments that make it worthwhile. Joking around in the few minutes between sitting down and the teacher demanding we turn to page this or that, the locker room razzing, the lunchroom roundtable discussions. But it's more than just fun. Development researchers say a different kind of learning happens here amid the countless social interactions that school provides.
In the beginning, nobody was talking about kids missing anything besides the academics. We're not really thinking about these kids that might really be losing a lot of skills that take time to develop.
That's Becca Lakin-Gulan. She's a professor of psychology at Gwinnett Mercy University in Pennsylvania and studies a kind of socialization older kids and young adults go through called emerging adolescence. It's something she thinks is lost in the back-to-school debate.
The American Academy of Pediatrics, they came out in June, I think, and made a statement that said kids should go back to school in person if at all possible. And I remember after that happened, people really, really, really got angry.
And with the virus actually picking up steam in parts of the country, they're scared.
And people weren't wrong in what they were saying, like, this is really scary and it's a health issue. But what the American Academy of Pediatrics was trying to do is say that it also matters to physically be present with other people.
Becca says these social interactions are a kind of practice for the roles we'll play at work and in adult life. They help us code switch between the person we are when we're talking job interview, when we're brainstorming with peers, or talking to a boss's boss. And even though all this stuff feels effortless, Becca doesn't think it is. We have to learn it. Tamar Kushnir heads up the Early Childhood Cognition Lab at Cornell University. She told me about this lesson she learned in the second grade.
I very much remember having a friend who was, she was a smaller girl, and she was easily picked on. And she was very smart, and I liked her. She was smart and bookish, and we talked about books and things that, you know, things we read. There was a big, mean girl who found her, she's about half the size of this girl, and she just found her very easy to pick on.
Tamar, though, was a big kid herself.
And I wasn't afraid of this girl. Maybe because I came up to her head as opposed to coming up to her knees.
One day, 8-year-old Tamar decided enough was enough. It was time to act. She walked over to the big, mean girl and her small, bookish friend, and she stood directly in between them.
And I learned how to stand up for my friend when my friend was being picked on. I learned how to put my body physically in between a person who was being mean and a person who I cared about.
The crucial thing to keep in mind about this whole episode is Tamar did what she did without anyone telling her to. She made the decision. Researchers think healthy people are born with this innate sense of something like right and wrong.
That we're social creatures and we're built with some capacity to understand harm and to be averse to it.
Whether or not you do act or how you act is where you get character, what Tamar calls moral agency.
One of the things that we in our lab think contributes to moral agency is just having made decisions yourself makes you feel empowered to do it again. So having one experience, you felt like an agent. You felt like you stood up and you said, no, this is wrong. Even just one experience like that can make you feel empowered to do it a second time.
I spoke with Tamar near the height of the Black Lives Matter protests that followed the police killing of George Floyd and other unarmed Black Americans. I asked her if she thought about the demonstrations differently, knowing all this. And Tamar says she sees all these strands of childhood social experience in the type of adults we become.
Learning how to help other people and stand up for what you feel is right, despite the fact that someone might be bigger and stronger than you, is a lesson that a child can learn at age 7 or 8 or 15 in a context where people are different.
Tamar says you learn from everyone you interact with, even those you don't really talk to. It's not just friends or bullies. Every single person brings some different variable that doesn't exist at your house between you and your parents and your siblings.
You have to learn who you are and in relation to other people. And you can't learn any of that by doing worksheets or flashcards or math problems.
These are things we learn by interacting with others. You learn about the complexity of others, and you also learn who you are or who you can be. A big thing Tamar talked to me about is the way kids push themselves in school. They try their limits, but that's not so easy in a virtual setting.
When COVID happened, I felt lost.
That's Caitlin again, our student reporter. She's a rising sophomore at a performing arts high school.
I found myself becoming, instead of this, you know, extroverted Caitlin, this Caitlin that was so outgoing, so out there, someone that wasn't scared to do anything. I found that Caitlin becoming more timid.
Part of it, she thinks, is that the only role she gets to play at home is someone's kid.
That's just how it is. Teenagers all have their things to hide, and I'm someone who, you know, I have to put on that I'm your child personality, and I can't be the way I want to be.
Caitlin told me her freshman year at this artsy high school was like a chance at a fresh start, to be who she considered the real Caitlin, kind of quirky, kind of out there. She says she thrived off the energy of her classmates. She spoke up, but she worries all of that is changing.
Becoming more nervous about speaking in front of others. When I was someone who was the first one to raise my hand and be the first one to talk in front of all these people and not be scared of what they were going to say, but now I found myself scared. I found myself quiet.
Becca, the psychologist and researcher, told me she's worried about this type of thing happening to kids kept apart from their peers for too long. They unlearn the type of social interaction that used to be normal.
You know how they say, you know, you go, say you start working out, you start exercising, the first few days are just terrible. But then after a while, you just get out of bed and you do it, or you go and you do it, and it doesn't feel as exhausting. And I think that it's the same thing with social engagement. There was something to the fact that we were continually working that muscle.
The big worry for Becca is that when schools finally do open, too narrow a focus on academic recovery will take up all the air in the room. That things that build social interaction will be seen as extra. Recess will be canceled. That's on Caitlin's mind, too.
And now we're not going to go back to school until November. I have to learn how to be the way I used to be.
She's decided she can't just sit around waiting for school to open its doors.
I have to learn how to learn from the situations in my own household rather than the situations in school. And I have to learn how to thrive off of my own energy rather than other people's energies. And that's something that I have to work on.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman together with our high school reporters. Coming up, the health effects of coronavirus on kids. What we know, what's still unclear.
Many of us, myself included, underestimated the impact of this virus on children.
That's next.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
This is Class of COVID-19, a special production from The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about kids' lives during this pandemic and the impact on their health.
Hi, my name is Zach Hitchens. I am 18 years old and I live in Newark, Delaware.
Zach had coronavirus in March.
At first, like, it all just started with a little stomach ache. And I was like, you know what? I've been hearing a lot about this disease thing. I should probably stay home from school. I started developing, like, more and more symptoms. My fever got a lot higher. It went up to, like, 103 at some point. I felt a lot of my energy drained throughout the day, and like I could barely get out of bed most of the time. I had a lot of rashes on my face and then on my chest. People just kept texting me and were like, oh my God, do you have it?
Remember early on during the pandemic, many experts thought kids didn't get the virus at all or they didn't spread it.
Many of us, myself included, underestimated the impact of this virus on children from the very beginning of this pandemic.
That's Adam Ratner. He's the director of pediatric infectious diseases at Hassenfeld Children's Hospital at NYU Langone.
the role of children as a vector for spread in this pandemic is not settled. And I think when this is all over, we will realize that kids have probably played a larger role in transmission than we initially thought.
So that is one fear with schools opening back up. Will kids get the virus and then give it to their entire family? The other big worry is kids themselves getting very sick from the virus.
Some of them have bad respiratory illnesses. We've seen a lot of gastrointestinal illness, but we've seen, you know, kids with respiratory failure from acute COVID-19 who require mechanical ventilation.
And then there's also the multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children that we've been hearing about. It's called MIS-C.
Which seems to happen about a month to a month and a half after the initial infection with COVID-19. This is happily still a rare syndrome, and that seems to be from an inappropriate activation of the immune system that occurs late in the course of COVID-19 infection. These kids present with fever and rash and sometimes with gastrointestinal symptoms, less often with respiratory symptoms, although that can be part of it. They often have red eyes. But again, we are at the very beginning, I think, of understanding how MIS-C is initiated and how we can best either prevent it or best treat it.
Adam says most of the kids who've had MIS-C have recovered. And can we be sure that MIS-C is tied to coronavirus? Just because the numbers are so small. So is there certainty about that?
No. And you're right to ask that question. I think that there are very suggestive epidemiologic data, but that does not establish causality. And I think that the fact that we saw our peak here 4 to 6 weeks after we saw our peak of coronavirus, the peak that was seen in the series that was published from Italy and in the group of patients that were seen in the United Kingdom, those all seem to have a similar lag and a similar sort of presentation of MIS-C. But there may be other factors at play also. I'm happy to speculate. I do think that MIS-C is linked to COVID-19, but again, I've been wrong about other things in this pandemic and may be wrong about that, or more likely may have a view that is too narrow.
So there's a lot at stake here, a lot of unknowns, especially with kids going back to school. Adam is a pediatrician and also a dad, so what's his opinion?
My take on this is that it is very complicated, and that anyone who's being honest about this issue, I think, has to be struggling with it to some extent, because there's not a clear right answer here. And I think that's the most important thing to communicate, that the right answer may vary by region, it may vary by city, it may vary by family. There is no doubt that in-person school is of benefit to children, to families, and that it, in most cases, works better than distance learning. At the same time, there's no way at this point in the outbreak to do in-person school without assuming some degree of risk to the children and to the adults that are with them in the school. And I think it's important for people who are pro going back to school and people who are against going back to school in person to acknowledge that on both sides. That doesn't mean that you can't decide that risk is worth taking based on the benefits that are associated with in-person school.
Adam Ratner is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at NYU. You're listening to Class of COVID-19, a special production from The Pulse. Doctors and parents have been especially worried about the impact of the virus on kids with compromised immune systems. Conventional medical wisdom tells us that immunocompromised children are especially vulnerable and need protection. But is that really the case here? Liz Tung has more.
Quarantining and taking lots of precautions is nothing new for Karen Marsh and her 18-year-old daughter, Victoria.
We've always kind of done what everybody is doing recently. So for the past 5.5 years, we've been conscious of who were around and how they might be sick. And Victoria's had face masks and had to be careful about who she was exposed to.
That's because Victoria has osteosarcoma, a kind of bone cancer. It's hard enough to treat on its own, even harder because Victoria has Down syndrome, which affects the way she metabolizes drugs.
It's a tough diagnosis. A lot of, you know, and we will fight this disease forever. We just don't know how long forever is.
Right now, Victoria's health is relatively stable. I catch her and Karen in the middle of their family beach vacation after a long afternoon out on the boat.
I don't know.
Can you say?
Maybe I caught 3 or 4.
3 or 4 fish?
Yeah.
In one day, right?
Yeah.
Every time she put her line over, what happened?
I caught a fish.
You caught a fish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the main treatments they've relied on in fighting Victoria's cancer over the last 5 years is chemotherapy. It's helped, but also had a profound effect on Victoria's health and immune system. Even a common cold could pose a potentially deadly threat. So Karen's always on high alert for signs of infection. A few weeks back, on July 12th, one of those signs arrived. They were having their nightly post-dinner cuddle, watching TV, when Karen noticed that Victoria seemed a little warm. She took her temperature. It was 99, not so bad. But by a half hour later, it was up to 100. That meant it was time to call the hospital.
I think it's 100.5 is when we have to make that phone call, because the fear is that she could be developing a blood infection and it could get septic and it can get really serious very quickly.
This is standard operating procedure for immunocompromised kids. What was different this time was before Victoria could be admitted, she had to be tested for COVID-19. A couple hours later, the results came back. She was positive.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, being told that we had to go to the ICU because she tested positive, that was a little scary.
It was just a precaution. The ICU is where the hospital's COVID unit was, but it still freaked Karen out. So far, Victoria's only real symptom was the fever, which disappeared shortly after they'd arrived. But Karen couldn't stop worrying.
So in my head, my worst case scenario is what you hear about on TV, where everybody's on a ventilator.
She watched Victoria like a hawk, waiting for all the dreaded symptoms she'd heard about on the news to appear. But except for a slight cough, none of them ever did.
Never had a fever, never felt crappy, never got sick, never was nauseous, never had aches and pains.
After a few days, Victoria was mostly back to normal. In the meantime, Karen and several other family members had also tested positive for COVID-19. None of them ended up getting sick either. That was lucky. But with Victoria, it felt like a miracle. How could it be that people with regular immune systems were getting seriously sick or even dying from COVID, while someone like Victoria had emerged basically unscathed? To find out, I talked with Salwa Suleiman. She's a pediatric infectious disease physician who works at Nemours Hospital, where Victoria was treated. And she says over the past few months, she and her colleagues have noticed a surprising trend among their immunocompromised patients.
They are not getting sicker, which has been a really fascinating discovery that none of us really expected.
Salwa sees a lot of immunocompromised kids. Kids like Victoria, whose cancer is being treated with chemo or radiation. Kids with genetic immune deficiencies or HIV. Kids taking anti-rejection drugs for organ transplants. In other words, she sees a lot of kids who are vulnerable in more ways than one. So as COVID-19 made its way into the U.S., Nemours, the hospital where Salwa works, started tightening up their safety guidelines. More hand washing, more masks, more quarantining. But for all their safeguards, all their fears, Salwa says immunocompromised kids seem to be doing no worse than their peers, with mild symptoms and low rates of infection.
And that's across solid organ transplant, bone marrow transplant, you know, primary immune deficiencies, patients with cancer getting chemotherapy. So it's not just one specific group and their immune defect. It's sort of across the board.
It didn't seem possible. But as it turned out, researchers across the world were finding the same thing.
The severity of disease doesn't seem to be associated significantly with immunocompromised in a way that you would expect.
That's Philip Zachariah. He's a pediatric infectious diseases physician at Columbia University Medical Center and hospital epidemiologist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, both in New York City, which means Phillips had a tough few months.
I think I probably speak for most people in the medical profession in that in New York City, and that this has been, at least in my lifetime, an unprecedented event.
Part of what made it so hard, Phillips says, is they were dealing with something brand new. Medicine's an evidence-based science, and at the start, they had precious little evidence to go by. So Philip and his colleagues decided to start collecting some by carrying out a study dedicated to helping them figure out how COVID-19 behaves and which kids were most likely to get sick.
What I can say about the first few cases is that, at least from the onset, we were able to see that, like, even within pediatrics, there seemed to be a spectrum. So I think that it was not like every case we saw initially was getting really sick.
Months and several thousand patients later, scientists have started getting a grasp on what the people who are getting really sick seem to share.
One of the common threads underlying severe COVID-19 seems to be some dysregulation of your immune system. And particularly in adults, on day 5 to 7, there appears to be this over-exuberant immune response, and I think it is termed a cytokine storm, which seems to lead to a lot of the damage that is happening.
You might have heard of cytokine storms. It's a phenomenon where the immune system overreacts and releases a ton of cytokines, this protein that triggers the immune cells to start attacking the body. It's basically massive and sometimes deadly inflammation.
If there was probably a point in time where you didn't want to have a huge, robust response to an infection, then this is probably it.
This, again, is Salwa Suleiman.
When we think about fighting off infections, you have your innate immune system, the immune system that you're born with, and then you have your adaptive immune system. The adaptive immune system is what sort of the memory you create. And so in some infections, it works beautifully. They work beautifully together. And then in some infections, the immune system goes so overboard that it then causes more problems, which we have absolutely seen with COVID-19 infection and this intense amount of inflammation that we see.
Scientists think this might be one of the reasons why immunocompromised kids are doing better than expected. It's not just because they're kids. It might also have something to do with the fact that their immune systems are weakened and therefore prevented from overreacting. It makes sense when you take a look at some of the kids who haven't done so well with COVID-19. Here's Philip Zachariah again.
So I think the fact that the immune system is being suppressed at baseline might have something to do with the fact that they do not develop the severe manifestations that some people with, you know, normal immune systems do. But I think it's too early to say.
I asked Karen Marsh, Victoria's mom, whether she'd heard about any of this, about the idea that immunocompromised kids might not be at any more risk than other kids, or theories about why that might be. She said she hadn't. And in fact, for all the hubbub surrounding the pandemic, it hasn't really changed that much about how she and Victoria live their lives. It's always been a balancing act between protecting Victoria and giving her a chance to live her life.
I have found that we've just had to kind of weigh the plus and minuses of taking those risks. To be honest with you, after a while, you have to decide, do you want to just sit in your house and do nothing, or do you want to kind of take a gamble and be out in the community?
Karen says it's different for every immunocompromised kid and their parents. Everyone has to do their own calculations, weighing risks and benefits. But for them, it's paid off.
What did we see when we walked down onto the beach?
A rainbow.
Was it a little rainbow?
No.
It was a huge rainbow,
yeah.
Huh? It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. Over the summer, we worked with a group of high school students who reported stories about their lives and how the pandemic has affected them. Here's one of those stories from Trinity Hunt.
Hey, my name's Trinity. I'm a 16, going on 17-year-old girl, about to enter my last year of high school, something I've looked forward to since the beginning of my school career in kindergarten.
Yet, it's hard to look toward my senior year with anything but fear and sadness because of, well, you know.
The pandemic has put a screeching halt to pretty much everything Trinity and her friends were looking forward to. They got together online to talk about their fears and hopes for their senior year.
First, there's Jackson. He's the sensible one, the one who gives the best advice. He's also very goal-oriented, probably because he's a high school football player.
So I've actually been playing football since middle school.
Then there's Ivanka. She's the baby of the group, even though she's the oldest. She's also quite intuitive and the most social out of all of us, even during quarantine.
Getting from quarantine, I actually did go to a party.
I feel like every time I go out somewhere, like after 2 weeks pass, I'm like, oh, thank God I don't have corona now.
Me too.
I feel like there's like the 2 week period and I'm like, do I have corona?
I guess because I go out all the time. It's like every day I'm like, nothing yet.
It's that moment of relief and yes. You're breathing fine and all of that.
I can breathe.
Because of COVID-19, there are so many things that high school seniors traditionally experience that we never will.
Definitely senior privilege.
Senior privilege is when a high school senior is allowed to come to school late or leave school early when they have a study hall first or last period. Of course, with virtual learning, there is no study hall, so as seniors, we won't get the special treatment we've been waiting for all our lives.
Probably my senior football season. Like, you get your senior game and you get your last homecoming game. Every sweet moment is that much sweeter in your senior season.
Because it's like, that's the last time. So let's talk about the lunch and the windowsill, which we probably won't get to do now.
I know. That's like our thing.
What Ivanka and I are talking about is the windowsill. Our windowsill. We sat at the same windowsill in the cafeteria for lunch for the past 3 years. That's our place where we can take a break from classes and talk about things not related to academics.
I don't know how they're going to do lunch. Like,
we eat in class, I think.
What?
Yeah, we're eating in class.
I can't believe we're going to be seniors. We're going to be adults. Jackson, you're turning 18 in January.
I'm excited about turning 18. I'm not excited about graduating high school. I don't want to be fully an adult.
Me neither. That just seems so weird. Like, we're going to be the oldest people in the school.
I literally am the same height as some middle schoolers. I do not feel like a high schooler.
So that's what the mind of a high school senior looks like. Scared yet? Just kidding. But seriously, that's how seniors think. We value our friendships. We say like and way too much. We learn and we grow so that when adulthood hits, we're ready for it. So, Corona, you can try to mess with my senior year all you want, but my friends and I will always find a way to safely come out on top.
That's Trinity Hunt.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye, guys. Bye-bye.
Class of COVID-19 is a production of The Pulse at WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We collaborated with students from WHYY's Pathways to Media Careers Youth Employment Program with support from the Lundfest Foundation, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and Bank of America. Our students were Sammy Saxith, Caitlin Rodriguez, and Trinity Hunt. Special thanks to instructors Gabriel Sedright and Becca Morgan. Our Pulse Health and Science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jed Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.